Okay, friends, the story begins. We are on page 78, and we are getting close, man. We're getting close to the end of Shacharis, of the morning service.
I think we should have a Chinese dinner.
Celebration, Asiyum. I agree. I agree for sure. I think we should. If you go to page 78, we skipped the stuff that are specific to Rosh Chodesh, specific to Elul. Maybe we'll get back to those. We'll see. But if you look on page 78, this is toward the end of the service. There's the famous Ein Kelokeinu prayer that we sing at the end of davening. We're going to talk about that next week. In preface to the Ein Kelokeinu prayer, there's these three sentences. You see it? Three sentences about hope. You know what's interesting? I'm learning a lot from this class. I never realized the three sentences are such a big deal. We kind of just like get through them, you know, get to Ein Kelokeinu. But they're actually a very big deal. They're of ancient practice. It wasn't, and it was stuck into the Siddur very intentionally. It wasn't just like, yeah, just put the. There's a lot of things in the Siddur that are very intentional, and they're very easy to overlook, and there's so much discussion about them. And these are certainly no exception. Let's read them in English real quickly. Hope in the Lord, be strong, and let your heart be valiant. Okay, excuse my English. In Hebrew, it's just a synonym for strong. Is valiant a synonym for strong? I'm assuming in English. Okay.
Yeah, valiant.
Valiant. Okay, there we go. Okay, let's start that over. Hope in the Lord, be strong, and let your heart be valiant, and hope in the Lord. No one is as holy as the Lord, for there is none aside from you, and there is none mighty as our God. For who is God except the Lord? Who is mighty other than our God? Okay, before we discuss why we recite this here at this point in the Siddur, let's take a step back and just get to the context for a second. This is a biblical quote. It's a quote from the first sentence is from the book of Psalms of Tehillim. Chapter 27 of Tehillim. And the commentaries point out that this chapter of Tehillim is King David asking God for three things: asking God to show me his face. Well, asking God to, number two, not hide his face from me once he does show me his face. And number three, to tend to my needs, show me your ways. And the psalm concludes with hope in the Lord, be strong, let your heart be valiant, be strong and hope in the Lord. The commentary, the Malbim, if you ever want to learn Tehillim in depth, or if you want to learn any part of the Bible in depth, really, look at the Malbim. Malbim is one of the classic commentaries, and he has great explanations. And the Malbim explains that King David wanted his needs taken care of. And King David realized that if you want your needs taken care of, go to the provider of needs. Because if you connect to God, everything else kind of fits, clicks into place. Because God is the source of everything. God is the source of everything good. So if it connects to the ultimate goodness, everything's going to be okay. So King David is on the run for his life. And, you know, he's going through a lot. The one thing he asks for is a connection with God. Because he realized once that fits into place, so will everything else. And King David says, hope in the Lord. Okay, let's talk about hope for a second. Hope is an interesting thing. Tikvah, right? What is hope? So again, this commentary, the Malbim points out that our hope in God is very different than our hope in humans. When we hope and rely on people, it's not the same thing as relying on God for two reasons. Number one, relying on people is a sign of weakness. Relying on God is a sign of strength. In fact, the Sefer HaChinuch writes that the whole Amidah, asking God for our needs, why are we focusing on ourselves when we're praying to God? So he says the whole thing is ultimately depending on God, realizing we're dependent on God. Okay, so Mike, your question, a good question. The question that you see that you wrote here, that the word hope is used rather than the word trust. Okay, we'll get there in a second. I don't know if I have a direct answer, but I think what we're going to say will answer your question to some degree. Because usually in Judaism, we talk a lot more about trust than about hope, right? And usually the difference is trust is unreasonable, or you could trust even when the solution seems unreasonable, whereas hope is usually reasonable. And King David here is hope. I guess he believes it's reasonable. He believes the help is reasonable. And when we do hope in God, so number one, we're not weak, we're strong, in contrast when we need to rely on people. Number two, this is what the Malbim says. Number two, this is interesting. Usually, hope is a means to an end. When you hope on people, when you rely on people, I have hope that the doctor will help, the accountant will help, my plumber will help, whatever it is. The hope is a means to some sort of outcome. But when it comes to our relationship with God, the hope is part of the relationship. The hope is not just a means to an end, it's an end within itself because it's part of the relationship. If I have hope in God, I've already succeeded before I even got what I needed. Again, similar to what the Sefer HaChinuch, the Book of Education, writes, that when it comes to prayer, praying for our needs is about realizing we're dependent on God. Even if we don't get our prayers answered yet, we've already won. We've already succeeded just by having that realization. The more esoteric commentaries point out that the word hope, kaveh. So look at the Hebrew. Look at the Hebrew for a second. Take a look at the Hebrew. Kaveh, see it? What's the root word? It's a two-letter root word. Kav. You know what a kav is? Anybody know what a kav is? Kav means a line. A line. When you draw a line, that's a kav. When you hope in God, you're creating this line between you and God. This ability to draw down divine energy from God, divine influence from God. Hope creates this line, this kav. Kaveh, tikva, creates a kav. It's a line between me and God. Now, the way the Malbim, let me just backtrack for a second, which is the previous commentary we explored. The way he explains it is, if you hope in God, you will be strong. Your heart will be strong. Right? That's how we're understanding it. Hope in the Lord, be strong and let your heart be valiant. If you hope in God, you're going to be strong. But another way to look at it is hope in God, create this line between you and God. And how do you do that? By being strong. See the difference? One interpretation is that hope gives you strength. And the other way to look at it is that no, if you strengthen yourself, you can have hope. You can create that line. They're both correct. It's a bit of a feedback loop here. You have to strengthen your heart. Your heart has to be valiant. What does that mean? The Midrash describes the difference between a tzaddik and a rasha. What's the difference between a tzaddik and a rasha? We know this from chapter 17 of Tanya. The difference is a tzaddik rules his heart, a rasha is ruled by his heart. I'll say that again. A tzaddik rules his heart, a rasha is ruled by his heart. And if we have a strong enough heart, we've strengthened our heart. So it's not dominating us, but we've strengthened it rather than it dominating us. We know how to live intentionally. That's essentially what a tzaddik is. And fine, maybe we're abandoning it, an aspiring, you know, we're aspiring to live intentionally, right? But we're on that path of trying to live intentionally and not just to be emotionally consumed by life. When we do that, we have the ability to hope. We have the ability to create this line between us and God. Make sense? What's an example of this type of hope where you strengthen yourself to create this line between you and God? So I'll give you a bit, I'll give you a biblical example. The story of Hannah, the Haftorah that we read on Rosh Hashanah. Are you familiar with this Haftorah? We read the story of Hannah. She was the wife of Elkanah. She was having trouble bearing children. I'll recap the story in a moment, but the reason why I'm telling you this specific story is because look at the next two sentences. The first one, again, we quoted from the book of Psalms. The second two sentences, which is the second line on 78, none is holy as the Lord, for there is none aside from you, and there is none mighty as our God. For who is God except the Lord, who is mightier other than God? Where are these verses taken from? They're taken from the book of Samuel. They're taken from the book of Samuel, where the story of Hannah is recorded. This is Hannah declaring that none is holy as the Lord, and there was none aside from you. There was none mightier than as our God. Hannah herself is declaring there's nobody mightier than God. Because what is the story of Hannah? So Hannah was married to, let me just give you the time period, the chronological significance of this story. This is one generation before King David, right? So this is where the tabernacle, the Beis HaMikdash, essentially the temporary Beis HaMikdash, was not yet in Jerusalem. Jerusalem had not yet been conquered. The Jewish people were living for the most part in Shiloh. Shiloh was the temporary capital for 400 years before the construction of the first temple in Jerusalem. So close to 400 years, the Mishkan that we're learning about in this week's Parsha resided on a relatively permanent basis, almost as long as the Beis HaMikdash itself, for close to 400 years. And there was a gentleman named Elkanah. Elkanah had two wives, which back then was permitted. In Judaism, multiple spouses are prohibited, but there was a time where multiple wives was permitted. It just wasn't working. Gets expensive. No, just kidding. Elkanah had two wives, Peninnah and Hannah. Peninnah had many children. Hannah did not have many children. And there was an incredible superiority complex, jealousy. And Hannah was in, I shouldn't say jealousy, whatever. The point is, Hannah was in a lot of pain. Similar story between Rachel and Leah with Jacob, right? Hannah was in an immense amount of pain. And she took a trip up to Shiloh. Some say that this happened actually on Rosh Hashanah, which is why we read it, and one of the reasons why we read it on Rosh Hashanah. She takes a trip to Shiloh. And she goes into the Beta, into the Mishkan, into the temporary sanctuary, dwelling for God. And she begins to pour her heart out. She begins to cry. By the way, just put this in brackets for a moment. Many of the laws of prayer and how we pray today, we pray quietly, we pray standing in one space, we pray audibly, even though we're whispering. We derive this from Hannah. She is the model that we use to learn how to pray. Right? This is discussed in Talmud tractate Brachos. Mike, you'll get there, right? Maybe you guys are there already. Page 30, 31, 31, 32. Okay, not yet. Hannah is standing there in the temple with her eyes closed, but she's whispering. And in her mind, I'm praying. And again, there was no formal Amida back then. So the concept of standing in one space, closing your eyes, whispering and praying looks kind of funny, especially for those who aren't familiar with the Amida. So the Kohen Gadol, his name was Eli, comes and accuses her of being drunk in the temple, which is prohibited. Shouldn't be drunk in the temple. And he says, "You're drunk and you're here. What are you like? What are you?" She says, "I'm not drunk. I'm pouring my heart out to God." Different kind of drunk. "I'm pouring my heart out to God," because she wants to have a child. And Ailey actually apologized, blessed her with a child, and a little bit later, Samuel the prophet was born. She says to God in her prayer that, "God, I want a child, and I'll dedicate him to you. He's going to be dedicated to you." And Samuel actually ended up being a prophet. He was also, I think he was a Nazir. I think he was a Nazirite. The reason why I share with you the whole background here is because I want you just to psychoanalyze Hannah for a second. Understand the level of hope she had. The doctors told her she's barren, she's not having any children. Was not in the cards. Was not in the stars. Wasn't gonna happen. It made no sense to ask for that. Why would you pray for that? Literally makes no sense. Why any normal person would shut that door and say, "I'm gonna start thinking of adoption or thinking of other options," right? So I see, yeah, Sarah as well, right? Sarah, I don't know if she prayed for a child. Like God blessed her with a child, but I think she kind of came to terms with it. Hannah was not willing to come to terms with this reality. She refused to accept it. She had this hope. And any cynic would say, "Hannah, you're going to be disappointed. This is a false hope." One of the reasons why we read this Haftorah on Rosh Hashanah, I read this in one of the talks of the Rebbe's talks. He points out something fascinating. She prayed for something that made no sense scientifically. She wasn't meant to have children. Spiritually, you don't get to say, "I'm God, give me a child and I'll dedicate him to God." It doesn't work that way. That's the child's choice. I mean, you can educate the child, you can inspire the child, you can hope that he follows in the path that you wish for him to go. But at the end of the day, like the Talmud says, Hakol b'yedei shamayim chutz miyirat shamayim, everything's in the hands of God except for the fear of God. That's going to be up to the child. She prayed for that too. What she prayed for made no sense scientifically, astrologically, if you believe in that, spiritually. Nothing. Didn't matter. That didn't stop her. She didn't come to terms with that reality. She didn't close the door. She had hope. And what we're saying is that that hope, that strong heart, the kaveh creates a kav, creates a channel, creates a line to allow those blessings to enter into our lives. She says, "There is none mighty as our God." Take a look at the second line in the Hebrew, middle of the page, right after the comma. Ve'ein tzur kelokeinu. There's no tzur as our God. Tzur, they translate as mighty, as strength. They translate tzur as strength. You know my issue with translations. I'm not saying it's a wrong translation. It's not a wrong translation. The problem with translations is there's multiple ways of translating a word, and if you're translating, you're picking an agenda either one way or the other. You're forced to pick a side. Tzur means strength, more euphemistically. You know what a tzur literally means? A rock. What is my rock? Her God is rock solid. She believed in a very strong God. Her faith was rock solid. And one might say, "This is a false hope. Give it up." And she says, "I have hope in my God, and that's my strength." Some say that the word tzur comes from the word tsayer, to form, to create, referring to God as the creator. Because she is essentially saying that, "God, you created the reality of science. You created the laws of physics. You're not limited to it. You're not bound to it. Miracles do happen. Miracles happen all the time." Why do we recite these verses here, right now? It seems kind of random. We finished the Amidah, we finished the Tachnun, Song of the Day. We're about to dive into In Kelkenu and Aleinu and then call it a day, right? Well, let's pull a fast one on these guys. Get them to Kiddush a little bit later, right? Stick in these sentences. So the commentaries explain that very often we finish praying and we doubt ourselves. Were my prayers accepted? Did I pray properly? Am I going to get what I want? Was I worthy? Was I praying in the, you know, with the right intentions? So we recite these sentences, hope in the Lord, hope in God, almost reassuring ourselves that we got to have hope. We got to believe that God is listening to our prayers. As we're wrapping up the prayer service, we remind ourselves of that. The Talmud actually quotes this sentence: hope in the Lord, be strong, let your heart be valiant, hope in the Lord. It says hope in the Lord twice. Because, and the Talmud says the reason is because if you pray and you don't feel like your prayer was successful, don't come to terms with it. Hope in the Lord. It says it again, right? Do it again. And do it again. Do it again. Don't come to terms with. Don't take no for an answer. As Jews, we don't take no for an answer. We don't do that. We're not supposed to do that. I'll tell you one more story of hope. I may have shared the story with you in the past. I don't remember. It's also from the Talmud, Tractate Brachos. Yeshayahu, Isaiah, was visiting Chizkiah, or maybe Chizkiyahu. He was visiting Chizkiah. They were friends. Hezekiah. And Chizkiah was ill. That's why he went to visit him. He was ill. And Chizkiah says to Isaiah, you're a prophet. Maybe you can give me some insight why I'm going through this pain, going through this illness. He says, it's because you never engaged in procreation. He says, the reason I didn't engage in procreation is because I saw through prophetic vision who my children were going to be and what they were going to be like. And Isaiah says, you have a mitzvah to procreate. You don't get to play God and start deciding that not worth it. Not a good idea. Who knows what they're going to be like? Raise them. Raise your kids. Do your best. Pray. But you don't get to decide not to bring them into this world. You don't get to do that. And at this point, he's deathly ill. So he says, okay, well, you have a sister that's single. Can I marry her? And he goes, nope. He just chastises him for not procreating. And then he says, okay, how about I marry your sister? I don't think so. Why not? He says, what do you think? So he says, what are you afraid of? We have a tradition that even if you have a double-edged sword at your neck, you don't give up praying till the last second. You don't give up. You don't give up hope. We don't come to terms. We don't take no for an answer. As Jews, we always have confidence that God is listening and that reality can change. Okay, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.